Walter Yetnikoff was the head of CBS Records, Columbia Records, from 1975 through 1990, a time when he lived an age of excess, as he calls it in his new book, Howling at the Moon, The Odyssey of a Monstrous Music Mogul in an Age of Excess. Welcome to the show, Walter.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing just fine. Let's start off with something other than the artist that you work with and talk a little bit about the music industry itself. When you were the president of CBS, was it about the music for you or was it about the money?
It was about both. I said in the book, and I probably used the wrong term, that I was tone deaf. That's not what I really meant in that sense. What I meant was that I heard music, or pop music anyway, in the same way the average man heard it. I did not hear the snare drum in the background. I heard the vocal.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I meant by it. And that, in some ways, that's good because your taste is the same as the people who make the hits, who buy the records. But I didn't have, you know, a musician's take on, you know, music or on pop music. That's what I meant by tone deaf. I probably shouldn't have used that term. Some of the music, you know, enthralled me. I mean, I can remember a couple of times hearing things that sort of rooted me to the ground. Of course, I was also interested in making money and making profit. The name of the business is the record business.
Right.
It's not even the music business. It's the record business.
Right.
I was running a business, and I was interested in making money. But one way to make money long-term is to work with the artists in a proper fashion, to nurture them, and to get the best music out, which is something I don't think is happening today.
Yeah, so you didn't have to like a song to say, okay, this is going to be a hit single?
No, there were times when I would hear something, and I'd say, this sounds like a hit single. And my personal taste, I could put aside.
Mm-hmm.
There were times people whose opinion I respected would come to me and say, this is a hit thing, this is a hit artist, and I could put my personal opinion aside. There were times when my personal opinion coincided with what I thought was an accurate commercial judgment. I mean, one of the things I used when I first heard Sly and the Family Stone, it's a family affair.
Mm-hmm.
I think Sly Stone was more whacked out than I ever was. I
went,
like, family affair, and I said, that's a hit.
Uh-huh.
When I heard some Springsteen stuff, I said, you know, that's a hit.
Mm-hmm.
When I heard Billy Joel at one point, his career, you know, took off, although there were a couple of records before Piano Man, it took off, and then there was a record after that, I don't know if you recall it, called Turnstile.
Sure.
Which didn't do so well.
Yep.
And at that point, he was on the road, and I ran into his manager. I was at a concert, who happened to be his wife. And I said, gee, the show is great. I actually looked at the audience more than I looked at the artist in that time. And she said, we have to get off the road because I don't have money. I said, did you ask? She said, yes. I was turned down. I said, call again tomorrow. You won't be.
Mm-hmm.
I had already heard The Stranger that followed the next record.
Yep.
And I thought that was a hit. So I liked it. So there were times my personal opinion and my commercial judgment coincided.
Yeah, I've been a big Billy Joel fan for a long time. I think the first time I saw him was in 1976. And what's amazing is that because of songs like Just the Way You Are and She's Got Away and a couple of other ballads along the way, he kind of got this middle-of-the-road, adult contemporary image to some people. But anybody who went to one of his concerts knew this guy rocked.
Absolutely. I always thought just what you just said, that a lot of people thought he was sort of soft. He wasn't really a rock and roller. He had a softer image. But even on that side of things, his songs, almost every one of them, had some kind of message. I know people in that era who say, I'm waiting for Billy's next song to tell me what to do.
Mm-hmm.
That may have been a little too much. But his songs did have a message. They were carefully thought out, and I agree with you. At his concerts, he was a rocker.
Yeah, absolutely.
He was a piano-playing rocker.
Absolutely. Now, speaking of concerts, in the music industry, when you were there in the 70s and 80s, or the record business, as you call it, were concerts to sell records, or were records to sell concert tickets?
Both. There was a time where artists could play in a nightclub, you know, in the 50s, maybe the very early 60s. They didn't have to have a hit record. Later on, with the explosion of the music business, which I peg arbitrarily to the appearance of the Beatles, you know, at Shea Stadium.
Yep.
It's not quite accurate, but sort of accurate. That's when the business took off, you know, and became a big pop thing. In order to have a really successful concert tour, you had to have a hit record, or else you really couldn't do it.
Right.
So you had to have a hit record to have a concert tour, and a successful concert tour would promote your record sales.
Mm-hmm.
So it was sort of symbiotic.
Speaking of the Beatles, you developed a business relationship with Paul McCartney, right?
We signed Paul McCartney, yes.
And what kind of businessman was he?
You know, he was astute in some ways. I mean, there were, you know, among the most astute artists in terms of business was actually Mick Jagger.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, Jagger, you know, he's either a graduate or his father was a professor, I forget which, at the London School of Economics. He is very, very good at this stuff. And if he decides to retire and stop running around the stage, maybe he'll get tired. He really should run a record company because he's very good at this kind of thing. Paul was not quite that detailed a business person, but he knew enough to retain copyrights. He knew enough that what people call publishing, the ownership of the copyrights and the songs were very valuable. In fact, when we signed him, one of the major deal points is that I gave him at a very cheap price the Frank Lesser catalog. That was a major deal point. He wanted ownership of the copyright. So in that sense, he was an astute businessman.
Yeah,
and he also had some very good people around him.
And much of the money that keeps coming into him is because of these other people's works that he owns the publishing rights to, and royalties keep coming in, and I'm sure there are giant checks showing up at McCartney headquarters every day.
I'm sure Paul McCartney has a lot of money. I mean, I'd be shocked if he didn't. But he had good people around him. You know, his father-in-law was a guy named Lee Eastman, who was a very, very shrewd copyright lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
His actual lawyer was Lee Eastman's son, John Eastman. That is Linda McCartney's brother.
Right.
And he's a very, very shrewd, very good lawyer.
Now, when you're dealing with a Paul McCartney or a Mick Jagger or a Bruce Springsteen or a Michael Jackson or any of these monster artists, Barbara Streisand, and we're talking about monster contracts, millions of dollars that's passing through there. You're the president of the record company. Is there part of you that says, you know what, I'm working pretty hard here too. I want to get my share, and did you?
I actually put those thoughts aside. Of course, that crossed my mind. You know, I'm more than any particular artist, what I'm doing is contributing to the welfare of the record company.
Mm-hmm.
However, I was ego-driven, but not ego-driven enough to think I was an artist. It's a whole different kind of thing. An artist is more like a baseball player. I was more like a manager.
Mm-hmm.
The thing with the baseball player and the artist is they had to have a different kind of ego than I did, because I had 200 artists. They had one.
Right.
When they got out on stage, a lot of people could not deal with the celebrity ego of some of these people. They thought it was terrible. I didn't, because when you get out on stage and you're a performing artist, you're not saying love my music, really. You're saying love me. And suppose they don't. No, you have to have a really tough ego in order to do that kind of thing. So I was okay with it. Did I think I should have paid more money? Yes. But frankly, I got paid pretty good. Not like, you know, Bruce Springsteen, but I was not a creative type like that.
Right.
And I know people at certain times who said, I'll be damned if I'm giving, you know, an 18-year-old guitar player $5 million. I didn't feel that way. Because if I gave an 18-year-old guitar player $5 million, I was probably making, or the corporation was probably making 10.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at one point, as an aside to that, after Springsteen released the first Greatest Hits album, the real one, he accumulated like $20 million in royalties. If you recall, there were people lining up. We couldn't put out those records fast enough. And he earned like $20 million, and I presented him and his management with a check for $20 million. I didn't bother to tell the CBS board. It's a normal course of events, you know, he earned it.
Right.
But one of them who adopted the attitude you're talking about, yeah, how come you gave him $20 million? You didn't tell us. I said, because he earned $20 million. That's why.
Yeah,
it's my pleasure to do that.
If we can give
him something, we made 50.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you can give him 20 and we can make 50 for us, that's a pretty good deal anybody should take.
And I said, and leave me alone and go back to your knitting.
Now, when you're dealing with a Bruce Springsteen, who a tremendous artist, but also a guy who likes to do these personal projects, and I can remember like the Nebraska album. He didn't want the E Street Band on it. He wanted, this is just going to be me and a personal solo project. And you're the guy who, you know, you'd like to give him another $20 million check so you can get the $50 million check. And you know Nebraska's not going to bring you that $50 million check. How do you deal with a guy like that?
Well, you know, I also thought I knew, and I did know, one other thing, that Nebraska, which I called Omaha, just as a joke,
yeah.
And I remember listening to it, and Bruce is pacing outside. We were at his manager's office, and I liked the record. I liked the songs. I thought it was part of a growth and a maturation process, and I was prepared to support him in that. And he came in, he was nervous. What do you think? I said, I really like the record, but like you just said, I can't sell a zillion copies of this. But we will treat it with dignity. We will treat it with respect. And it's really a good record. It doesn't have a rock and roll band on it. So you'll only get your hardcore fans. You're not going to get the rock and roll world. And he said, that's fine. That's exactly what I need. And I was given the luxury in that era of being patient with that kind of situation. And it's true, we sold like 800,000 to a million, which is a lot, but not for Bruce Springsteen. And the next record was Born in the USA. And the next record was the real first Led Live record. So 50 million records later, right, that sort of long-term thinking paid off.
Yeah, you indulge
today, you don't get that. You really don't.
That was my question. You indulge them short-term, you earn long-term. Nowadays, there is no long-term thinking, is there?
No, everyone is greedy. You have greedy corporations. You have sometimes greedy artists. You have greedy record executives who, in my view, are overpaid for what they're doing. There was a reporter from the New York Times referred to some of those people as Teflon record executives. They look good. They're slick. They just don't make any money. And, you know, there is a corporate responsibility to do that, too. If you keep losing money, there's not going to be a business. But I contrast that with the George Michael situation. I was leaving at the time. He didn't give them what they wanted because they wanted another Wham record. And he wanted to outgrow that. And he wanted to develop as a more mature artist. And they wanted, I want your sex, and he should kiss the Chinese girl, you know, in the video.
Right.
And that's not what he wanted to do. And he wasn't given the opportunity to do what he wanted. And he's a pretty good artist. And then there was a lawsuit, which is never a good idea for anybody, except for me. I like lawsuits.
You do?
Yeah, I'm a lawyer. I think it's great. I wrote this book, and people said, oh, you're liable to get sued. I said, oh, Jesus, please. can you encourage someone to do that?
Yeah.
But for an artist like George, this is not a great idea, I don't think. He got into a lawsuit where a dozen years later, and his career was foundered, you know, in the interim.
Yep.
He may come back. I don't know if he will or he won't.
No, I think that bathroom incident hurt him a little bit as well.
Yeah, but, you know, the bathroom incident, yeah.
Yeah.
But basically, that is somewhat the result of the fact the company was not being patient with him.
Walter Yetnikoff, author of Howling at the Moon, The Odyssey of a Monstrous Music Mogul in an Age of Excess. This is the Paul Harris Show, back with more in a moment on the Big 550 KTRS. This is the Big 550 KTRS. I'm Paul Harris talking with Walter Yetnikoff, who was the head of CBS Records for 15 years and writes about it in his new book called Howling at the Moon. The title comes from a story of you in Tokyo getting in trouble with your new corporate bosses, right?
Yeah, I was like crazy. I would wander out into the Tokyo night, and this started in like 1968, before there were a lot of Westerners there. It was not a cosmopolitan city. It was very Japanese. And I didn't want anyone around me. I could have had virtually anything I wanted. I wanted to wander free in the night, and I would find my way back. I could not do this today. I don't know how I did it. One day, they used to call me the crazy American. I was like too hyper, and they put a security guy, Sony did, at the door. They wouldn't let me out, so I opened the shutters, and I was howling at the moon. You know, let me out of here. It's also sort of a euphemism for insanity.
Yeah. Were you having a nervous breakdown?
No, I don't think it was a nervous breakdown. I didn't get nervous breakdowns. I got crazy periods, very hyper, a lot of drugs, but not in Japan, because, you mentioned McCartney earlier. I was always afraid of drugs in Japan because he got busted. If they can bust Paul McCartney, they can sure bust me.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't go into nervous breakdown type things, although I suppose I might have acted strange at times.
You lived a life of sex, drugs, drinking, and rock and roll for many, many years. And when you're hanging out with people in the rock and roll world like a Mick Jagger, I'm guessing that's part of the package.
It is part of the package, but funny you mentioned Mick Jagger, because I think that most of the time he was pretending that he really wasn't drunk or high or whacked.
Hmm.
What he was doing, he was trying to get you drunk or high or whacked so he could put one over on you.
Oh, yeah.
Very shrewd.
Get you drunk and then make a deal with you and come out on top?
Yeah, I never took his blood sample, so I don't know.
Yeah.
But that's my impression, that he was so shrewd that he would seduce you into, you're going over the edge, but he's pretty sober.
Who was the other end of that spectrum? Who was the biggest partier you hung out with?
Early on, James Taylor, before he got straight, but James is straight many years now.
Right.
He had some strong stuff associated with him in an earlier day.
Yeah, heroin.
Yeah, he was off that, and he was on to other stuff. But he was pretty serious addict. But he's clean a long time now.
You have a reputation for dealing not only with contracts, you're the king of the contracts, but also with dealing with these artists up close and personal. Tell me a little bit about your relationship with Michael Jackson.
Well, you know, in the book I refer to the fact that I became his daddy, you know, his emotional daddy, not his real daddy. And there were times where he would come to me and say, you know, Walter, my father never really tells me how proud he is of me. You know, Michael has got, at least in that era, there was a part of him that was like a little baby, like a real child. There was a part of him that was very shrewd. You know, he bought the Beatles catalog at what seemed to be a very exorbitant price, and obviously turned out not to be.
Yep.
It was a very good deal.
Right.
But Michael always had to be number one. You know, during the Thriller time, I'd get calls in the middle of the night, you know, Walter, my record's not number one. What should we do? I said, we should go to sleep, and we'll deal with it tomorrow. you know, he had to, and he once said to me, you don't understand, I was a star at six. I don't know a real normal, I didn't know a real normal life either, but more normal than that. The only time I feel alive is when I'm making a record or I'm performing. So he came from a whole different background. In that era, he was almost not of this world. I don't think he was comfortable with adults, particularly. He was okay with me because we knew each other well. I tried to talk to him about some of that surgery and some of that, you know, wackiness which was starting, and I got absolutely nowhere. And he wouldn't argue with me. He would just turn his head away.
You even say in the book, in every sense of the word, Michael was bad. As I watched him change over the next 5 or 6 years, I was alternately impressed and alarmed. And I guess that was around the era of Thriller and Bad and
right,
all that.
Right after Thriller.
When he was really changing physically and in many other ways. What alarmed you?
Well, what alarmed me was this, you know, that the good part that didn't alarm me is he was always talking about marrying pop music and dance. And did it in a way that no one had ever done it before. You know, Thriller was almost like West Side Story with its choreography. But he started to, with the surgery and the changing and the skin tone and all of that stuff. You know, I would try to talk to him. I said, Michael, you're a good-looking black kid. What are you doing? What are you doing? And he would not respond to it. Then the parabolic you know, oxygen chamber, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And he was like lonely. He didn't really have friends. I mean, his friends, Elizabeth Taylor, you know, that's sort of an oddball friend.
Yeah.
He was close at one time to Diana Ross. She was like his godmother.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think so later on. I don't know that. So he started to get, you know, strange with the oxygen chamber and the constant surgery. That, I think, alarmed me the most.
What was his relationship like with Quincy Jones, who's the genius who really produced Thriller and made it a huge success?
Well, on the surface, it looked great. In fact, Quincy used to kid him and call him Stinky. I don't know where that came from, but I think it was an affectionate term, nothing more than that.
Okay.
But as you know, when they were awarding Grammys for Thriller, he called me and he got me in California the night before the Grammys, which I was attending, and he said, you know, I really produced the record. Quincy shouldn't get a production credit on it as co-producer. He didn't really produce it. So, Michael, calm down. One, he said, intercede with the Grammy people. Tell them to withdraw Quincy's nomination. I said, Michael, you can't do that. The Grammys are a television show. They're not doing that. Two, Quincy Jones is a very known figure in this town, Los Angeles. Three, Michael, I saw him produce the record. I saw him produce the record. What's wrong with you? There is enough to go around here for everybody. There's tons of Grammys. You don't need every one of them. Then the night of the Grammys, he was up there with Quincy, and he called me up and he said, Walter Antonikoff, the best record president in the world, come on up. So that's very unusual because it's a television show. They don't need record execs. It's looking for celebrities.
Right.
So everything on the surface, you know, was all friendly and stuff. But underneath, he was trying to get me to push Quincy out. Now, he denies it because his PR people called some of the book people or some interview which I did and said, this is hurtful. Hurtful is a PR buzzword these days, I think. There's only one problem. There was a witness to the conversation.
Yeah. The problem is it's true.
The problem is it's true, yeah. Now, it's not, you know, and then he said, Quincy is my friend. I said, well, that makes it worse. So that was sort of that insatiable hole that had to be filled with more success, more of the trappings of success, and all of that kind of stuff. And this is America. There's nothing wrong with that. But I don't know that it ever fills the hole.
How do you deal with an artist like a Michael Jackson who had had some success as a solo artist after you took him in the early 80s, and then he comes up to, I guess it was 1983, and he's got this album Thriller, and he wants to make a video for it, which was standard at the time, and he doesn't want to make just a regular short 3 or 4 minute video. He wants to make it into a movie, and John Landis is going to be involved and all that sort of stuff. You're the head of the record company. Do you indulge somebody like that because you can see the vision of how great it's going to be, or do you say, you know what, this guy's making me a lot of money, give him what he wants?
Don't always say to people, he's making me a lot of money, give him what he wants, because that could change it. Now, I didn't know the Thriller was going to turn into what it turned into, but my instinct was that Michael, who said to me a number of times, you know, I want to bring dance to pop music, that he was going to succeed in doing that.
Yep.
You remember there were at least two prior videos. It was Beat It and Billie Jean.
Right.
Both of which were quite good, but Thriller just went over the top. We didn't even want to, we never considered Thriller to be a single. I mean, the lyrics are not for a single.
Right.
Until the video.
Yep.
So Michael's talent, is, you know, particularly in that area, is not to be denied. I heard some of your broadcasts earlier while we were waiting that there's all sorts of maybe evidence going on in California. It's very sad. I don't know what the facts are, but it's like, I sort of heard someone saying that there was allegations that there was a female mannequin, an 8-year-old. I mean, this is icky.
Yeah, that's exactly the right word for it, icky.
Yeah. Ugh,
yeah. Know. One last question about Michael. While he was having this tremendous success with Thriller, his videos were not being shown on MTV. MTV did not have black artists on there. It was all that early 80s new wave kind of pop sensibility of bands like A Flock of Seagulls and Men at Work and those kind of groups. How upset were you as a record company president that you couldn't convince this great promotional outlet to showcase your guys' stuff?
Well, I was upset enough, and this was pre-Thriller. This was the era of Billie Jean and Beat It.
Right.
Because they didn't want to play, you know, a black artist. I was upset enough to say, in effect, hey, you know, that's very interesting. I think I'll go public with that statement. That should do you a lot of good. Two, if you don't want to play black artists, that's one thing. But Michael Jackson is not necessarily a black artist, a pop artist, whatever the, you know, his ethnic origins are. As a musical artist, he's not doing R&B. And three, that's a crazy, stupid thing to do, because if it were black music is like a seminal type of thing for rock and roll, really. Rock and roll grew out of it. And I got a hold of Steve Ross of Warner Brothers, because Warner's owned a piece of MTV at the time, and threatened to pull all our videos, not Michael's videos, but all our videos, unless he fixed it. And Quincy Jones, to his credit, also got in the act at that time and called Warner Brothers and said, you know, this is crazy, you can't do this. And they gave up. Thank God.
And that really changed MTV and turned it into not only a huge success for Michael's videos, but also a huge success for MTV itself.
For themselves, of course.
Yeah. Walter Yetnikoff, author of Howling at the Moon, The Odyssey of a Monstrous Music Mogul in an Age of Excess. This is the Paul Harris Show, back with more in a moment on the Big 550 KTRS.
This is a different kind of talk radio. The Paul Harris Show on the Big 550 KTRS.
What's the matter with the clothes I'm wearing? Can't you tell that your tie's too wide?
Billy Joel, one of the guys that Walter Yetnikoff had working for him when he ran Columbia Records from 1975 through 1990, and he worked in the music industry for years before that. And after you and Sony ended your relationship in 1990, did you continue to work in the industry? What have you been doing since then?
Well, you know, right now what I'm doing is we have a little soundtrack company, me and a lady named Tracy McKnight, who's a music supervisor. She's like the queen of the indie music supervisors. We formed a little company. We're putting out soundtracks. We have a relationship with Lionsgate, and we're being offered a whole bunch of soundtracks.
Do people still call you and say, hey, we've got this artist and we're having trouble, and so you consult them on that sort of thing?
Yeah, I still do a little bit of that stuff. If I do consulting, I actually don't even charge people for it most of the time. Right now, actually, because you had mentioned Billy Joel, there's a soundtrack coming out on Miramax, a movie with Martin Scorsese. It's called The Aviator. And I'm going to see if I can reach Billy, because I don't think he wants to sing these days. But he always regarded himself as a writer, to see if he would be interested in writing a song or a score for the Scorsese film. and see if I can put the two of them together.
I think he would be great at that. He's experimenting with the classical stuff, and
his tunes
have been turned into the Moving Out Broadway show.
Right.
And I think he'd be remarkable at that.
Yeah, I want to try to convince him for the two of them to talk, because he indicated an interest in that. If that happens, I get the soundtrack.
Well, that's good business for you, which is always the bottom line, yeah.
And I've been approached lately, just recently, by a lot of people who control talent, who say, look, I control some major talent. They're really not happy with the major record companies. Like, no one seems to be particularly happy with them. And would you be interested in getting back in the business if I gave you a major talent? I have to now think about it, because the soundtrack label Commotion is great, and we have signed a few individual artists, who've approached us. However, to go in it in a bigger way, I've got to expand that. And I like my life the way it is right now, because I'm doing that. I am involved, believe it or not, in an experiment in the dissemination of music over the Internet with the brother-in-law of the governor of the state of New York.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And he is not Pataki. He's married to the wife, Libby Pataki. I'm sorry, it's a brother of Libby Pataki. And he's an artist in Denver, Colorado.
What do you think the Internet has done to the music industry? There's all this carping about downloading, killing off music. What do you think of that?
Well, right now, what I think it is, yeah, there has been downloading. It has been a problem. But every time there's been a new thing that's come along, it's generally been good for the record industry if embraced properly. You remember FM radio?
Yep.
It created a whole new type of thing. It enabled music radio to play things like Stairway to Heaven. AM radio would never play that.
Right.
It enabled a whole bunch of things. It fulfilled a very bright promise. Then you had MTV at the beginning. That fulfilled a very bright promise. Then you had CDs. Everyone was complaining, oh, CDs, we're going to have to get rid of our tape factories and blah. That fulfilled a very bright promise. They were all, after some hesitation, embraced by the record industry. Now comes the Internet, and it's not quite being embraced by the record business. In part, I think the current record management likes the brick and mortar they have because they make a lot of money. They themselves, the companies don't make that much money these days, but they like their big bonuses. They don't want to do anything different. They're afraid to take chances. You like the state of pop music today? It's a little milquetoast.
Yeah.
Everybody copies everybody else.
Right.
I'm exaggerating. But because they're afraid to take a chance. You think Bob Dylan will get a record contract today?
No.
Me neither.
I don't think a lot of these artists who would not be TV-friendly would get record contracts these days.
So now you have a situation where you have the Internet, and the record industry responds by suing everyone. Maybe that's the right thing to do. I don't actually think that younger people who were using Napster and MP3 actually thought they were doing anything wrong, because they used to file sharing. So it does require some education. But, a lot of records today have two or three songs that are good on them, and the rest is not. It's thriller.
It's filler, rather. We talked earlier, Walter, you were saying how in your day people thought long-term, or you tried to think long-term, and nowadays there's too much short-term thinking. I can remember when I started my radio career, with time when you were at the head of Columbia Records, I worked in an FM music station, and at midnight we'd have the midnight album, and we would just play both sides of the record all the way through, no commercial interruption, just let it track right through, and we knew that there were people out there who were taping that to make copies of themselves, and the record industry knew that this was going on. And the record industry would provide us with extra copies to give away, and there'd be all these freebies out there, because they knew that if somebody liked that album by that artist now, the next time that guy or woman came out with an album, they'd go out and buy it.
Well, that's not the attitude today.
No, it's not.
The attitude today is if you don't sell a whole bunch of records right off the bat, we drop you.
Yeah.
Because there's too much focus on the immediate bottom line. Too much focus on the immediate bottom line means sometimes you take your lie off the long-term bottom line, like the younger, that the people who would tape the artist you're talking about, but on the next record would go out and buy it.
Yep.
And the Internet is an example of that. Sony the other day finally decides that they're going to get into the Internet downloading, situation, so you can play it on all sorts of Sony gadgets and stuff. But, they experimented with a little thing here, a thing here, but they never really embraced it. They are schizophrenic. Some of these record people, they say, yeah, Internet, great, wonderful. And then they turn around and wish it would go away.
But
it's not going away. There are ways to embrace it. I am not the world's living genius on that. I'm involved in one of the things. It took Steve Jobs, who was a stranger to the record business, to come up with probably the best idea to date. But it's not the only idea, and it gives young people or anybody who likes three songs of a record the opportunity to legitimately download three songs.
Yep,
I don't think people want to steal. I don't think kids are looking to rip artists off. They don't know. But so here's an opportunity. Where's the rest of the record business, or the whole record business? Sony finally announces they're going to do this. The reason it's been held up is because there's been an argument or a dichotomy between the hardware and the software people, meaning the record people didn't want it.
Right.
Well, you know, is that the fault of the consumer?
No, I think that the record industry, the music industry, has really missed the promotional vehicle of the internet big time, and they're slowly starting to catch up, but maybe it takes people like Apple and others to push them in that way, and maybe that's the way it's going. Now, speaking of promotional vehicles, what do you think of American Idol?
You know, basically, it's not to my taste. I have to be on Fox Channel 5 later on, in early evening, and I've been cautious, don't say terrible things. Now, it's not to my taste. The kind of stuff that this very middle-of-the-road type of thing, this current guy, Hung, I don't think it's very good. However, it is a populist medium, and if the people want it, and it does give, this is America.
Yep.
You know, we're supposed to be governed by the will of the majority.
Yep.
If people like it, then people like it. Then American Idol provides a vehicle for that kind of thing for people. I personally don't find it to my taste.
Gotcha.
But, you know, I'm saying, you know, this is America. We are governed by the populist majority.
In reading your book, you do tell this life of excess, this life of sex, drugs, rock and roll, and of the artists who you shared it with or you were busy overseeing them while you were living this parallel life to theirs. Would you have wanted to be the president of a company that had to work with an artist named Walter Yetnikoff?
Only if he had a little more talent than I do.
No, but you know what I mean? I mean, were you too much trouble for somebody like you?
I don't know the answer to that. I was certainly not too much trouble for CBS.
Yeah, you turned him from a multi-million-dollar company into a multi-billion-dollar company.
Yeah, now, I mean, when I was running the company, granted, times were different. There wasn't the downloading problem, this, that, and the other thing. But we were making $450 million a year, net pre-tax profit. But net, everything that had to be written off was.
Yeah.
That was more than MCA, or what today Universal was making, the whole thing. Movies, everything. So we were making a ton of money. Now you have the same company losing $200 million a year. Now, I don't say that that's all because I'm not there. For that inference, if you want. I made a lot of money, or we made a lot of money.
Yep.
And they, you know what? It was not that aggravating for them, because basically they just turned the other way and said, "Do what you want."
Well, as I told you off the air during the break, this is the story of a lot of people who were making music at a time when I was starting out in the radio business, and so it was thrilling for me to be able to see those inside stories about some of these people that I dealt with from afar, and also to read your stories of your debauchery through the years. And I will warn people, this book is a little bit raunchy. You don't hold back on your own personal stories or on theirs, but it really is a great read. It's called Howling at the Moon, by Walter Yetnikoff, The Odyssey of a Monstrous Music Mogul in an Age of Excess. Thank you, Walter, for your
Take
time
care.
Today.
Thanks very much.
Walter Yetnikoff here on the Paul Harris Show. This is the Big 550 KTRS.